Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, another look at California's drought. What does it mean for the future of Valley agriculture? And is the boom in permanent crops like almonds, grapes, and pistachios a bubble that's bursting right now before our eyes? We'll talk to Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian and Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt to get their perspectives on the issues and how the Valley's ag community is preparing for this unprecedented situation. We'll also look at the challenges facing local Hmong youth as they navigate the gap between their traditional values and Western popular culture. And we'll find out why trails are disappearing high in the Central Sierra and what some people in California are doing to save them. Those stories and more up next on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero. It's not just the drought plaguing California citrus growers this season. Now comes word that the deep freeze from early December cost the $2 billion industry nearly a quarter of its value. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento.
Talk about a 1-2 punch between the lack of rain and the sub-freezing temperatures.
Well, there's no doubt about it. The two together give it a harder taste.
James McFarland grows 700 acres of citrus in Fresno County, and he says he's one of the lucky ones.
Even though we spent all that money on propane and labor to get those wind machines turned on and off, even though I, for about a 40-day period, I only spent two full nights in my warm bed, we're probably going to make more money because of it.
That's because his supply weathered the weather fairly well. Others did not. California's citrus industry estimates the cost of the 7-day December freeze at about $440 million. That'll lead to a shorter California citrus season in stores and perhaps higher prices for customers. I'm Ben Adler.
There's some momentum building for further increasing California's minimum wage, and one lawmaker is taking advantage of it. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento on a new bill introduced Monday.
President Barack Obama talked about raising the federal minimum wage in his State of the Union. A conservative activist in California is getting attention for his call to increase the state's wage. Now, Democratic Senator Mark Leno is trying to capitalize on that momentum. He's introduced legislation that would increase California's minimum wage to $13 an hour by 2017. The wage would be tied to inflation after that. Critics say increased wages mean increased business costs. But Leno says higher wages mean more purchasing power for workers.
70% of our economy is based on consumer spending. These are dollars that will be spent immediately, recycled in our local communities. So it will bring business to local small businesses.
Last year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that increases the minimum wage to $10 an hour by 2016. Leno says that was a good first step, but falls short of what's needed. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
California's historic drought isn't just affecting farmers. Water releases for the San Joaquin River restoration are being shut down by federal authorities in order to make the water available to 30,000 people in small communities who may run out of water this summer. The releases won't start up again until at least March 2015. Orange Cove, Lindsay, Strathmore, and Terrabella are expected to receive zero allocation of water this year. The cutback on the river restoration began Friday, 1 month before schedule. This is Valley Public Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last Friday, the State Water Project took the unprecedented step of cutting projected water allocations for its contractors to zero. And even irrigation districts that have senior water rights that date back to the early part of the last century are facing a sobering situation. And words like this from Congressman Jim Costa.
We have a 13% snowpack average, and there's just no water in the system right now.
While recent snow and rain has helped to clean the air, it's literally been a drop in the bucket when it comes to the severe conditions facing both urban and rural water users throughout the state. Here to talk more about the latest developments in this ongoing story, we're joined in our studio today by Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt, and we're also joined on the phone by Lois Henry, a columnist with the Bakersfield Californian. Welcome.
Hi, Joe. This is one of the biggest stories we've seen in years, and the news doesn't seem to be getting any better. Paul, I want to start with you. You're a farmer in Kerman. You have almonds and other permanent crops, also row crops as well. What does this mean to you right now? What are you doing different this year that you would not normally be doing at this time in a normal year?
Actually, we were offered a contract for onions last week, and I couldn't take it because I can't be sure about the water supply. So for our operation, we're going to be about the same, but we invested in a well a few years ago, and that'll keep us going this year. But wells are really Band-Aids. They're short-term. We need a secure surface water supply.
Now, I understand that a lot of farmers who maybe didn't plan as far ahead as you did are trying to go to well companies, and they're facing waits of well into 2014, into the fall, if not later.
Yeah, they are way backed up. We're actually renovating an old well. They pulled the old guts out of the well in October, and they haven't put it back in yet. And every week I call and they go, oh, one more week. You know, last week it was 5 to 7 days and we still haven't seen anybody out there. So they are ramping up. The company we work with has bought new equipment, but they still can't keep up with demand.
Now, there was a story that came out not that long ago that some farmers, even with permanent crops, are actually pulling out their almond trees with the knowledge that they aren't going to have the water that they
right.
were counting on. Are you seeing that?
You're seeing huge cutbacks in row crops as guys pull out row crops to save their water for their permanent crops. Questionable orchards, old orchards that need to be replaced are getting pulled out ahead of time. The guy who cuts wheat for us, he's lost 70% of his contracts. So he's only going to have 30% of his income this year as people have cut back and not planted wheat fields because of the water situation.
Now, turning to Lois Henry, who's also on the phone with us now. Lois, you had a column last week in the Californian that talked about the changing nature of Valley agriculture and how permanent crops have become so much of a fixture in areas where maybe they weren't in the past. And you sort of took Valley farmers to task for doing that in an era where water has been such an uncertain thing in the state.
I don't know if I would say I took them to task. I just asked a question that seems to be getting a lot of attention, and that is whether moving to permanent crops in such a large fashion, because it's not just converting, you know, our existing row crops to permanent crops, which we did on a large scale, but also developing new ground into farmed permanent crops, and that happened on a huge scale. Between the years of 2006 to the present, when decisions were coming down in regards to the Delta that were restricting and restricting and further restricting water. So I just asked the question if that's sustainable given the reality of the water situation in a non-drought year. And, of course, in this year, you know, all bets are off. I mean, we're going to see stuff that we would never have thought that we were going to see, never want to see. So I just asked the question, and, in fact, I've been talking to a lot of the water district folks here over the years and have asked them that question numerous times, and I've been pretty surprised that some of the water district folks are saying the same thing, that yes, we are overextended, and it's on permanent crops, because permanent crops, as you know, they need water year-round. You can't plow them under 1 year and then bring them back, you know, spring them back up to production the next year. Anyway, and I was kind of surprised that these water districts have talked about this. And, in fact, Semitropic, which is one of our largest water districts down here in Kern County, has a program where they're buying land and fallowing it. To me, that was interesting and newsworthy. I've been a little surprised at the reaction up and down the state. I don't think it's a sacrosanct kind of a thing to talk about, but some people have sort of approached me that way.
Well, I'd kind of like to get Paul's thoughts on this. You've seen the rise in permanent crops. You look at the annual crop reports for Fresno County, mm-hmm. Kings County, Kern County, and you used to see cotton at the top or near the top. Now you see pistachios, almonds, mm-hmm. grapes, these permanent crops that have been put in. What do you think? Is this a bubble that is bursting right now with this drought and the environmental water cutbacks in years past?
Well, when I got up here, there was a million and a half acres of cotton in the valley every year, and now we're down under, you know, 300,000-400,000 acres. So, yeah, there's been a huge shift. Westlands Water District is buying land, just like she was saying, Semitropic is. And, you know, I got to raise the question, too. I've got neighbors who've put in trees and don't have a water supply for it. That's not a good idea. that's going to get me in trouble.
But this is something that is a huge investment, and
right.
You're putting in an almond orchard. You're counting on how many years to get your money back, and that's term of investment is that?
You're
10,
making 20? A 20, 30-year investment, and to not have a secure water supply is a little on the not-so-bright side.
I would like to say something in defense of the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, a lot of people are kind of angry about me saying these things.
Well, we'll give you a chance to do that then.
Go ahead.
I brought up the drought of the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
and I brought that up for a reason, and that was because so many people, environmentalists and various other people during that drought, said that farmers in the Central Valley were being very irresponsible by growing low-value, high-water crops, alfalfa and cotton being amongst the two that were named in forage, you know. And so the Central Valley switched things up, and they said, okay, well, maybe we need to increase our water banking in Semitropic and Kern Water Bank and Kern County Water Agency and the City of Bakersfield all started these water banking operations down here. And farmers said, all right, let's switch then. If we're only going to get so much water out of the situation and the environment is going to be taking more, well, let's switch to these lower water, higher value crops being grapes and pistachios and almonds. And so they did switch to something that was they thought was going to be more sustainable. But as the decisions have continued to come down out of Sacramento that, you know, just ratcheted that water down further and further and further, it became harder to bank the extra water that would come out in high water years so that they could sort of, you know, roll it out during the dry years and save their crops and keep those permanent crops going. And so it's sort of like they tried and the situation kind of changed underneath them.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian and also Kerman farmer Paul Betancourt in our studio today. Paul, I understand from some people, or at least in some areas, and it might be different in certain parts of the valley depending on the quality of the groundwater, but in some cases, trees like almonds may not like the groundwater, especially if it's of different quality. Is that a concern?
Yeah, I don't know of a place in the valley where the groundwater quality is equal to or better than surface water. That's why surface water is so important. And that's where a lot of people are asking questions about the drought, and I appreciate Ms. Henry's comments. This is a multi-year problem when it's going to take multi-year solutions. Because you've got to look at the long-range thing, investments in permanent crops. You have both mentioned the environmental restrictions over the past few years. And so, yeah, we can pump water and I can get through this year, but that doesn't solve the problem. I have a water quality issue, and even in a good year, we're overdrafting the aquifer. So we're just making the problem worse.
Lois, in your most recent column in the Californian, you're talking about some water districts and some of the innovative things that they're doing to cope with this situation, fallowing land and also exchanges of water at some extraordinarily high dollar amounts per acre foot that we haven't seen in the past. What are you seeing there?
Oh, I think we're just at the beginning of the innovative stage of what's going to happen here. And you're talking about the column I did on Buena Vista Water Storage District, which has Kern River rights. It gets state water, it has groundwater, and it has very, very substantial Kern River rights. And so they've been very lucky and had the resources and have been able to store up a lot of water. And so what they're doing is they're going to sell 12,000 acre feet of that water, which is nothing valley-wide. In Kern County, it's also kind of a drop in the bucket. But their proposal is to keep it within Kern County, to keep it to ag, and they're going to use the money that they get from that water to pay their farmers to quit farming for the year on a voluntary basis. The idea is they're going to try and reduce the pull on the aquifer at the same time as they're going to sell some of their excess water to help their neighbors, which is very innovative and it's very interesting, and I applaud that. But then you get to the details, and it's $600 an acre foot. That's a lot for water districts. For ag, that's three times what you're going to pay regularly. And remember, these water districts are all still having to pay their capital costs for the state water project, even though they're getting not a drop of water. So, you know, they're really going to have to think, okay, we're already on the hook for this bill for which we're getting no water, and there's this possibility of this water over here from Buena Vista, but it is high. And not only that, Buena Vista is doing it on a bid. So the minimum bid price can be $600. What the top bid price is, we'll have to wait and see. So I kind of took them to task for that. I felt like, you know, look, you're offering to help out your neighbors, but it's kind of a little bit of price gouging, if you ask me. And then doing it via the bidding process sort of adds to a bit of desperation. You know, if your farmers really, really need it, you know, and you're going to bid for it, you're going to try and bid higher and higher. And I don't know that that's really all that fair. But I think that this is the beginning of what we're going to have to see in each different region and each different basin is people becoming much more interdependent and probably much more innovative than we have been in the past.
Paul, what are you seeing on that front as far as water transfers, purchasing water on the market? I've heard that there's just no water out there for the most part,
right,
that even, you know, you name the price, it can't be had.
And if we're talking $600 in January, what's it going to be in June? What's it going to be in July? What's it going to be in August? And it's still lost jobs. It's lost a local economy. It's lost tax base. So it's a drop in production. I had to go to a meeting in Kalinga a couple weeks ago. And you're talking about innovation. I saw people putting in drip systems all over the place. And mostly when we see drip systems, we think of permanent crops like vineyards or trees. Talking with these folks about putting these onions in, they were going to put in drip tape for 1 year. So there is going to be a lot of innovation. I was over in Israel in November, you know, and those guys are masters of drip because they have will about water. They're going to make it happen. You know, we sit here and dither about it.
Paul, farmers are generally averse to regulation overall. I think that's relatively safe to say.
You've noticed that?
I have heard discussion about one bit of regulation that may now have some support, at least from some in the agriculture community, and that's dealing with groundwater regulation and not just groundwater quality but quantity. If you're a farmer and you have that water under your ground as your backstop, and all of a sudden you go to pump it out of the ground and then it isn't there, or maybe you were banking water, as Lois mentioned, groundwater banking is big, big in Kern County right now. I've heard some talk about some farmers now being more willing to accept the state getting involved in regulating how people use their groundwater supply. Do you see that as being maybe an unintended consequence of this drought, Paul?
I'm hoping the unintended consequence is we get a bond passed soon. If you look at the California Constitution, farmers don't own the water under their land. It's owned by the people of California, and we're required to use it for reasonable beneficial use. And that's a surprise to most people. What irritates me about what you're suggesting is they've taken away the surface water, and now they want to regulate the groundwater. You know, sooner or later, something's got to give. And the environmentalists are going to have to sort out what they want, because this has been driven by environmental policy. Now, what's the number one environmental concern? Climate change. What's the way to reduce that? Reduce your carbon footprint. What do they want? They want food grown closer to consumers. We got 30 million consumers within a few hundred miles of the Central Valley. We can do it. We just need some water to help these people lower their carbon footprints.
Paul, before we go, we just have a few seconds left. You mentioned the possibility that a water bond could be on the ballot in November. There's been all sorts of talk about that. The governor has been very coy about whether he supports that or not. Do you think that is likely, and what would you feel is necessary for you to support that and your fellow farmers?
Well, while I'm praying for rain, the fact is if it does rain, that all the concern from non-farmers goes away. So we actually need a good nasty drought for us to get to talk about a bond, because now we're talking not, you know, the farmers have been short of rain for a couple of years. Now we're talking cities on the east side not having water, cities up in the Bay Area not having water. This will catch people's attention. My concern with the bond as it is, it's really $3 billion worth of water projects and $8 billion worth of lard. You know, let's get the water projects done. You know, even at $11 billion, it's, you know, not to open another can of worms, but it's better than a choo-choo. You know, you give me $5 to $8 billion for water products, I can help everybody in the state of California. These guys want to spend $60 billion on a train that only a few people are going to ride. So I hope that the drought's bad enough so people stay focused on it and look at the long-term consequences of it.
That's certainly a topic for another program. Again, our guests today have been Paul Betancourt, a Kerman farmer, and also Lois Henry, columnist with the Bakersfield Californian. You can find her columns online at bakersfield.com. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest.
Thanks, Paul.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute on Valley Edition and talk about the struggles young Hmong teens are facing here in the Central Valley as they reconcile their family's traditional values and religions with those of the West. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. The question of who am I is a normal one for teens, so it's no surprise that Hmong youth in Central California would face a similar struggle. They're grappling with the tribal religions of their refugee parents, other faiths encountered in the U.S., and the pressures of conforming to popular culture. Some have clung to the tribal ways of their ancestors, while others have lost faith altogether. Valley Public Radio reporter Ezra David Romero recently visited a group of Fresno Hmong high school students to bring you a glimpse into their struggle.
My Jua and my Chong Vang go to the same school, share the same list of chores, and are seemingly inseparable. They're sisters. My Jua is 17 and Chani is 15. The two Hmong American teens grew up in a Fresno family that practices animism with regular shaman rituals. But one thing divides them. Here's my Jua.
I do participate in shamanism, although I don't believe it.
And here's Chani.
I am shamanism and I actually believe in it.
Cao Li Yang is a Hmong anthropologist who has studied Hmong culture for over 25 years.
Shamanism is not a system of belief. Shamanism is a healing ritual practice. So what the Hmong people believe is animism. They believe in the multiple of souls. And they practice what we call the cult of the ancestor.
She says many young Hmong are confused about their beliefs.
More and more young people question about the faith.
Mai Jua says time and what she calls American influences have helped push her away from the religious practices of her Hmong refugee parents.
I guess it's like the theories that I don't believe. Like there's really no proof to it. It's just kind of like, I feel like sometimes it's made up.
But for Chani, shamanism is a point of connection to her family and heritage.
I believe that the spirit will actually help you, and it's basically how faithful you are towards that religion. And to me, I do believe that it will help improve my point of views and basically like show who I am.
These sisters face a struggle that Hmong teens are grappling with across the region. Do they assimilate to the culture around them? Or hold true to the values and traditions of their families? 16-year-old Jasmine Vang's story is a little different. She's not related to Jua and Chani, and she's Catholic.
The reason why I guess I'm so pulled or like strong into the religion is because besides shamanism, it was just the other thing that kind of gave me hope, and I found comfort in being Catholic.
She says many of her Hmong friends are trying to hold Western religion and ancestral traditions in the same hand.
What I feel like I need, that's what I take. If I feel like I'm struggling and I need prayer, then I pray because, you know, I'm Catholic. If I feel like I'm getting sick or if I need to find something and my mom needs to ask my grandpa to help me find something, she can call him up because he's a shaman too. He's a the actual shaman.
She also says outside pressures have made it hard to balance her social identity with her spiritual life.
I think the struggle is just finding who you are because there's just so many things your parents and, you know, society wants you to believe in.
It's a struggle that many Hmong teens have faced over the years, including Song Lee, who at age 38 is now a professor of counseling at Fresno State. She came to America from Laos as a toddler, but she says today's youth also have a different perspective than her generation.
Some of these youth have parents that are successful. You know, everybody has an iPad, iPhone. So they have more material stuff than we did.
Her fear is that since Hmong culture is passed down orally, this current generation of youth may leave out traditional practices altogether in their pursuit of the American dream.
I think if we don't do something now, they're going to lose that piece. Because for one thing, if you don't understand it, you're not going to embrace it.
Another Fresno State professor, Cao Li Yang, says many of her Hmong students don't know a lot about their culture or the difference between shamanism or animism. But she says assimilation isn't the main cause of the confusion. She blames Hmong culture itself.
Hmong do not socialize their children by explicitly explaining the rule or the culture content. Parents let the child discover the culture, discover the rules.
According to Cao Li Yang, around 70% of Hmong Americans are under the age of 24. And with Hmong elders aging, Yang says today's youth have a short window of time to regain what she calls their Hmongness.
Picture that I gave to my student is a tree. You have a big wind that is blowing, and you have to have your root solid on the earth. The Hmong culture is like the root to the earth. You have to have that. So the wind can blow as much as it wants. You won't fall.
She says that as teens like Mai Zhua, Chani, and Jasmine mature and define their own generation, that strong foundation will be essential.
If you still remember you are Hmong, if you are interested about your community, if you give back to your community, if you still try to create something that makes sense, make your life beautiful as a Hmong, you are still Hmong.
And it will be up to this generation of Hmong Americans to decide what that means. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The statistics are downright scary. This is the driest California has been in five centuries. And government climate watchers recently upgraded the drought from extreme to exceptional. But what exactly will that mean for residents of the Central Valley? Starting this week, Valley Public Radio will share an occasional series called Voices of the Drought. First up, FM 89's Rebecca Plevin brings us the story of small farmer Chia Lee.
Back in Laos, Chia Lee grew rice and corn on a mountainside. He never worried about rain there.
Didn't find a monsoon rain in Laos once a year, so we don't worry about anything.
But for the last 10 years, Lee and several family members have grown bitter melon, cherry tomatoes, green beans, and peanuts on a 26-acre farm in Parlier. He sells produce at a San Francisco farmer's market and to local packing houses. These days, he can't count on a monsoon or much rain at all.
Last year, I have 3 acres of cherry tomato, and by August, the water level dropping down. My pump couldn't draw any water, and I have been losing a lot of produce by last year.
This year, the situation is looking dire. He relies on a well and surface water to irrigate his crops. But this year, he's concerned his well may go dry, and he doesn't know how much surface water he's going to get. He also says his sandy soil is so dry that it soaks up water quickly.
If the water keeps going down like this, maybe we stop planting something because without water, no crop growing.
That would spell trouble for Lee and his family members who share the land. Lee leases the farmland and says he makes just a few thousand dollars off it each year. That, combined with his wife's salary as a teacher, must stretch to cover their three children who still live at home.
Just to survive, just enough to survive for the family.
In Laos, Lee and his family would hold a week-long celebration in April to pray for rain. He says it might be time to hold a similar ceremony at his Parlier farm.
Cook something and come in here and then praying for. Yeah, after a couple weeks, we see no rain and then do it again. For a couple of times, still no rain, we can't do anything.
He might have to do that soon. Lee expects to start planting in the next week or two. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Over the last week, you may have heard a series of stories on NPR about the oil boom that's currently underway in the upper Midwest. A team of NPR reporters has been covering the story in every possible way, from the pool halls of North Dakota to concerns about the environment. You can find the stories online at npr.org. One of the stories, though, has a local angle, as much of the oil from the Dakotas is transported to the West Coast by train, including through the Central Valley.
And in Bakersfield, a local refinery has plans to build a new rail terminal just to accommodate that black gold. Here to tell us more about the story is NPR's Kirk Sigler. He joins us now from NPR West in Culver City. Kirk, welcome to our program.
Glad to be here. Hi, Joe.
Kirk, you've been reporting on this story for a while now. Safety has been a big concern. We saw the situation late last year in the Dakotas and then also in Canada where a train carrying crude oil had an accident and there was a significant situation there. What are you hearing as far as safety goes? Because that's a big concern for those who have the tracks passing through their neighborhoods.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of concerns, especially due to the high-profile incidents that you just mentioned there. And being in North Dakota, I heard a lot of chatter about this, both on the state level and the national level. I should mention that the NTSB chairwoman was recently out saying that the current regulations on these oil tanker cars just simply don't reflect reality. There needs to be more safety measures, she said. People locally, North Dakota's governor, that derailment actually happened near the hometown of North Dakota's governor. He has been calling for tougher regulations. I think there is a lot of concern, and I think we'll see those regulations or tougher rules come in, frankly, any day now. There's just a lot of momentum for that. There's a lot of safety concerns. One of the main reasons cited is that North Dakota crude oil coming from the Bakken Shale Formation is highly flammable. There's also a lot of it coming out of there right now. Just drive around Southern California, you'll see these oil tanker trains. I was struck by just how many of them are coming across the northern plains right now towards the Pacific Northwest. They are everywhere. So this is also very much in people's backyards. So it's you can imagine people living along the route in these towns, some of which that were built around the railroads. There's a lot of calls for more scrutiny and tougher safety.
Now, as I mentioned, there's a local angle to this story. It's right now in Bakersfield, one of the big refineries owned by Alon is in the application process of a proposal to build a new rail terminal at their refinery in Bakersfield to accommodate what they call mid-continent crude or crude oil from the Dakotas from this Bakken Shale Formation. One of the big problems with that is capacity of the existing rail infrastructure. Tehachapi Pass has been an issue for a long time, and I know that you've been reporting on that as well. What's the concern there?
Well, Tehachapi Pass, as you mentioned, has long been a bottleneck. You know, when that was opened more than 100 years ago, it was an engineering marvel. But today, a lot of people are concerned about the amount of freight that can go over that pass, and there have long been plans by the state and Burlington Northern Santa Fe and other railroad agencies to widen the tracks, to add tracks along there. Most recently, some of the funding for that plan got scaled back, so no one knows exactly when this will all come online. The bulk of the mid-continent crude, as you say, though, that's arriving in California right now is actually arriving by barge from the Pacific Northwest. Now, there's an increasing amount of it coming in by rail, much of that coming in across the northern Sierra and then down through the Central Valley into Bakersfield. But you mentioned infrastructure. There's a lot of infrastructure proposed up and down the West Coast, Bakersfield included. That's relatively cheap to build and quicker than, say, a pipeline. But what's convenient about Bakersfield, as you mentioned, is that trains can come into the Bakersfield area and they can conveniently hook on to existing pipelines that go up and down California to some of the biggest markets in the U.S., the Bay Area, and, of course, here in Los Angeles. So Bakersfield is very attractive to this. The other thing that's going on is that I was struck by just how quiet a lot of this is going through, and I think I actually had a difficult time getting a lot of people to talk about it, and I think that crude by rail and some of the infrastructure issues and some of the facilities being built around Bakersfield in some people's eyes may represent a threat and to the local industry, Kern County being one of the most productive oil-producing counties in California and the nation, for that matter. Well, now you have all of this North Dakota and other so-called mid-continent crude that's going to maybe be coming in by rail. Will that have an impact on the local economy? That's another story that's perhaps in the offing that I'd like to pursue.
Certainly, and we will continue to follow this story, both the local angle, and you can hear Kirk's reports on NPR again. You can find his latest report on NPR.org and KVPR.org. It's part of the NPR series, The Great Plains Oil Rush. We've been talking with Kirk Siegler, reporter from NPR West in Southern California. Kirk, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Listening to Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. One of the best parts of living in Central California is our proximity to the Central Sierra. Right in our own backyard, we have treasures like Mount Whitney, the Kern River, Sequoia, Kings Canyon, and Yosemite National Parks, plus thousands of acres of national forest and wilderness lands. But when it comes to the Sequoia National Forest, budget cuts over recent years have taken a toll. In a new piece for the online magazine Zocalo Public Square, retired physician and USC Medical School professor Dr. Ken Murray says the demise of traditional ranger naturalists means many trails are literally disappearing, cutting off access to one of our most treasured natural resources. Dr. Murray joins us now on Valley Edition. Welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
Ken is not only a physician, but for the last 15 years, he's been a member of the High Sierra Volunteer Trail Crew. Ken, let's start out by talking about exactly what part of the Sierra we're talking about here. This is not in the National Park and in the big trees in Sequoia or Kings Canyon or Yosemite. This is the National Forest. Where do you do your work, and where have you seen some of these cuts have a real consequence?
Well, I've actually done volunteer work on six national forests in California, and the story in all of them is pretty much the same. It's worse in some, it's better in others, for a variety of reasons that are not clear, but they're all being affected by budgetary cuts over time, loss of personnel on the ground that actually do work, and as a result of the infrastructure, the natural infrastructure of the forest is deteriorating.
You talk about these trails disappearing. That's an interesting concept because we think of a trail as just being something that's there, but it actually requires maintenance, I understand.
Yeah, and it's important because trees fall on them, rocks roll onto them. You get an accumulation of brush that grows into them, leaves and needles fall on them, and gradually obscure them. That's a natural process. In older times, I think people would just go around all these things, but that creates erosion. And the Sierra Nevada represents the water source for California. So it's very important that we try to conserve our water resources best we can by maintaining high quality. The more erosion we have into the water, the worse the water quality is, and then it creates problems downstream, so to speak.
Now, you talk about the demise of the traditional ranger naturalists. When I go to the National Forest or the National Parks, I see rangers. But you're saying, yeah, there still are rangers in the National Forest, but they're different. They're doing different jobs than they used to do.
Well, there's been a kind of a morphing of anybody who's wearing a uniform into calling them a ranger. So we have policemen on the forest. They go to a police academy, they carry guns, they issue tickets, they can arrest people. They're policemen like anyone else. But on the National Forest, they're called law enforcement rangers. And the thing about it is, rangers, the term ranger connotes to me something quite different. And I guess it's a romantic residue of my childhood when I went into the forest with my family, and we would encounter traditional rangers who would educate, and they would be working on the forest and doing things to protect the forest. And those people are gone now.
So is this a separate issue from the trail maintenance
story
that you're talking about?
Well, they're intertwined because rangers do some maintenance. But they're not the predominant trail workers. There's really a separate cadre of people who are completely devoted to working on the trails. But they're gone too, so they might as well be the same.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Dr. Ken Murray. He's a physician in Southern California, but is also a member and has been for the last 15 years of the High Sierra Volunteer Trail Crew. He has a new article on Zocalo Public Square, an online magazine, called Why California's Trails Are Disappearing from Our Maps, and is talking about the Sequoia National Forest and other areas. Tell me about some of these areas that you go to. I understand you went on one trip to clear one rather significant trail that was quite an undertaking. Tell us about that.
The trail that you're referring to is called the Kanoia Trail, and it actually drops from the Sequoia National Forest down into Kings Canyon. So it traverses down into the park on the south wall. And this trail had not had any maintenance done on it in 20 years. And this was a 7-mile segment of trail. So when we got up there, and we actually had to use chainsaws to cut brush and trees to actually get the stock through. It was impassable even to get to the trail. Once we got there, we spent 20 days cutting nearly 700 trees that had fallen over the trail, plus associated brush removal and trail repair to restore the trail to its operating function.
Now, I understand that it's not just an issue of budget cuts. There's also a philosophical issue going on here in regards to the wilderness areas and the spirit of the Federal Wilderness Act that has designated some of these areas as areas untouched by man. They don't have roads, you don't have cars, motorized vehicles, things like that aren't allowed there, and it's an issue that forest managers are struggling with. What are your thoughts on the role of these trails? Should we have access to these areas, or is it best to maybe leave them alone? Maybe they're healthier without human interaction in those areas.
Well, I think it's hard to make a case for not having access because very, very few people go off trail in the Sierras when they go into backcountry situations. And the trails take up less than 1% of the land. So 99% of the land is getting no exposure to people whatsoever. So I think removing another 1% is functionally unimportant. And you brought up the issue of how we manage these lands, and there's a law called the Wilderness Act that defines how we take care of wilderness and what's supposed to go on there. And it mandates that we do things using the minimal tool necessary to get the job done. And this oftentimes represents hand tools, shovels and hand saws. Even to cut the trees, we can't use chainsaws. There are some slightly different rules in the parks, which sometimes allows them to do that, but that's on a park-by-park basis. But in the forest, universally, they do not allow the use of chainsaws, except in extraordinary circumstances or when safety is involved.
Do you have any idea of how many trails have been lost or decommissioned?
Well, unfortunately, as far as I know, no one's keeping track of it. So it's difficult to have an overall view of it. When you talk with people on different forests, though, let's say the people who maybe run the pack services probably know the trails better than anybody. On every forest, they relate trails that are no longer there that they like to use and take their customers in on. And you'll notice when you look at maps of areas of different vintage, you'll see trails in that are there at one time and then they're not there afterwards. But it's not tracked, so I don't have an overarching number.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Ken Murray. He's a member of the High Sierra Volunteer Trail Crew. He has an article on the Zocalo Public Square website called Why California's Trails Are Disappearing from Our Maps. You can also find it online on our website, kvpr.org. What do you suggest should be done? What's the one takeaway here?
Well, I'm happy to say there's a bright spot in all this, and the bright spot is what has happened with respect to volunteers stepping in and taking up the slack, at least to some degree. For example, in the Sequoia National Forest, there are no rangers and there are no trail crews. All of the work that's done now is done by various volunteer groups. It's not so bad on the Inyo or the Sierra National Forest, but still the resources are very strained. And for example, on the Sierra National Forest, they have a professional trail crew that 2 years ago had 45 people on it. And last year they had 10. And this year it's looking like they're going to have 5. So there's a huge cutback that's occurring. But the volunteers are taking up a lot of the slack. They do work that's equivalent to the professionals. They have to have the same training. That's a bright spot. The only thing I could say to folks is they should come out and join in with one of the many groups and give back to the forest themselves. They'll find it to be a very rewarding experience.
Again, Ken Murray, he is a volunteer with the High Sierra Volunteer Trail Crew. His article about the disappearing trails of the National Forest is available on our website and also at Zocalo Public Square. Dr. Murray, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 2014 will be a big year for California voters. Not only will citizens choose the state's next governor, who will represent them in Congress, and a lot of issues will also be on the ballot in the form of propositions. A handful of groups are currently gathering signatures right now to put the issue of marijuana legalization before voters in November. Other groups are working to put issues on the ballot ranging from an increase in the state's vehicle license fee to changes in the way school districts can fire teachers for egregious misconduct. And a referendum that would overturn the approval of a Central California Native American tribe's plans for a casino in Madera has already qualified for the ballot. Joining us now to talk more about reforming the state's initiative process is Mark Baldessari. He's the president and CEO of the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Joe.
You released a report late last year with some recommendations about ways to improve the initiative process in California. It's hard to believe, but it's been actually 10 years since the recall, well, over 10 years now, since the recall of then-Governor Gray Davis. What are some of the things that you found in this report as Californians reevaluate their very unique approach to direct democracy?
Well, we conducted a number of public opinion polls last year that asked questions about the initiative process and found that while the public still strongly supports their right to make public policies through the initiative process and they're generally satisfied with the process, the public across party lines and regions of the state and demographic groups feels that there's room for improvement, that there are areas in which the current initiative process does not serve them well. And there are three general areas that we found that a broad public support for changing the initiative process. One was to do more to connect the legislative and initiative process. The second was to increase disclosure of initiative funders. And the third is to find ways to reengage citizens in the initiative process. An initiative process, because of its cost, has largely been taken over by special interests in California.
Looking at some of those things, let's go through the three of them right now. Connecting the legislative and initiative process, how would the state go about doing that, considering they're so different right now? Voters can advance legislation, and then Sacramento has to deal with the consequences of some of those voter-approved laws. And in some cases, they have been very popular and successful. In other cases, they've presented a number of challenges to the way the Sacramento operates. How would you envision those changes taking place?
Well, the initiative process has been around for about 100 years, and for half of that time, there was available something called the indirect initiative process, in which the legislators could take up a measure which citizens were going to bring to the ballot and could review that process. And if there could be a compromise between those who were making the initiative, citizens' initiative process, and those in the legislature who were going to make a law, then that measure wouldn't need to necessarily come to the ballot. So what voters are telling us in our polls is that sometimes initiatives get to the ballot that really don't need to in their point of view, and sometimes they get to the ballot in a form that's either confusing or, you know, it's going to lead to some legal challenges so that the initiative, even if it passes, doesn't actually become law. So if there are opportunities for review at the legislative level, either review of the wording all the way to the possibility that there might be some compromise, voters are okay with that. What voters are not okay with, and they say this loud and clear, is that they don't want the legislature to have the power to change what the voters have already decided at the ballot box. So they're okay with a pre-review, but not a post-review of initiatives.
Another issue that's a very hot one in California, as you mentioned, is disclosure, transparency of who's paying for these efforts. Because in California, if you have the money and you are have an issue that you feel strongly about, chances are you can get it on the ballot in many cases. What were your findings along those lines in ways to increase the disclosure of who's paying for these efforts?
One of the areas of the initiative process that voters are most frustrated about and also most concerned about is that they recognize that people with large sums of money are getting involved in the initiative process, trying to influence voting, both yes and no, on the initiatives. And it's often hard to find out who is backing an initiative, who's funding the signature gathering, the advertising. The information in the voter information guide doesn't go far enough, and they want to know who's behind an initiative. Whenever we talk to voters in focus groups, this always comes out. Well, who's behind it, and what are they really trying to get, you know, from either supporting or opposing an initiative? And, you know, we feel that if voters had more information about the yes and no sides of campaigns, it would help them make decisions about what information they should take most seriously that's occurring in these debates. So we think that information on funders that's provided on the website of the Secretary of State through other government agencies that people can believe that's updated, very important for voters. And we also think that having televised debates where people could put names and faces to the yes and no side campaigns would go a long way towards many of the questions that voters are raising today about our initiative process.
Another thing that many people talk about in this process is this issue of citizen engagement and how people interface with the system. What are your recommendations there and ways to increase participation and everything from the voter guide to other things along those lines?
I think that it's safe to say that the initiative process has become so expensive as our state has gone from, you know, in the course of 100 years in which our state has gone from a state with a small population to one with, you know, almost 40 million people living in California now, that in order to collect signatures, in order to have a campaign, you have to have large sums of money. And starting with the process of signature gathering, we found in our polling that voters like the idea of making available the option of volunteer-only signature gathering that would be allowed to take more time, because today the time limits on gathering signatures is such that you pretty much, you're at a great disadvantage if you don't have a professional team trying to collect the, you know, 800,000 signatures for a constitutional amendment or, you know, 500,000 for a statutory amendment through the initiative process. So voters like that idea of volunteer-only signature gathering, being allowed to take more time, giving people the option of gathering those petitions and signatures. The other thing that we tested, which we found intriguing and would suggest California look into, is having an independent citizens commission that would hold public hearings and make ballot recommendations that would then appear in the voter information guide. Oregon has been experimenting with this idea of an independent citizens commission, which chooses what measures to study and then selects a jury of citizens to look at those measures over the course of a week and see if they can make recommendations to voters like themselves about whether this particular initiative, would be in the best interests of the people of their state. So we like the idea of considering the Independent Citizens Commission and a role for that group in holding hearings and making recommendations.
We've been talking with Mark Baldessari. He is the president and CEO of the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California. They have a report on their website about reforms to California's initiative system. It's available online at ppic.org. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Earlier in our program, we told you the story of local Hmong teens who are struggling with their faith, whether to adopt Western religions or those of their ancestors. That divide, though, extends far beyond religion. Popular culture and traditional values can also differ on things like personal appearance and what's a healthy weight for young girls. In this commentary, Edison High School student Mai Chong Vang tells her story of self-acceptance while belonging to cultures that promote opposing ideal body types and how Hmong and American perspectives have challenged her to accept who she is.
My name is Mai Chong Vang, but I go by Chani. I'm from East Central Fresno. My family is Hmong, and we practice shamanism. Living and growing up in my family, we feel that each person's health and happiness is a reflection of their spirit. Your looks, actions, attitudes, emotions, and perspectives can be interpreted as a symptom of the condition of your spirit. For me, my size concerned my family. The issue began at birth. I weighed 6 pounds and 3 ounces, and that was just too small. I was considered one of the two smallest children in my family. Since then, my weight has changed from year to year. 1 year, I'd be skinny and the next a bit chunkier. When I was in middle school, my parents tried to convince me to eat more. I was always the last one to finish eating dinner, and my mother would sit across the table waiting and watching to make sure I'd clean my plate. In my early teens, I began to notice the way my traditional parents and other Hmong elders expected me to look was different than the standards my American friends at school live by. It seems to me that in Hmong culture, thick girls are seen as more attractive than skinny girls, which is opposite from what I see in American culture. In their perspective, thick girls, not skinny girls, are healthier, stronger, and have more potential to do hard labor and produce healthy children. On many occasions, I've overheard my parents describe my male cousin's bride. If the bride is thick, they would happily describe her as stunning and strong. But if the bride is thin, they would describe her as scrawny or not as attractive. Because both Hmong and American cultures influence me, I am impacted by each set of expectations. I'm continually trying to figure out what's right for me, and I tend to try to follow American culture. I would prefer to be skinnier than thick, because American society judges people by their weight and wants you to be skinny and feel thin. I'm not super slender, but I feel healthy. If I were any smaller, my parents would judge me and convince me to eat more. At the moment, I feel like society is accepting me the way I am. But for other young Hmong women I know, they feel pressure to be skinny because they think it's healthier. I've noticed that many young Hmong women feel bad for not being as skinny as a runway model. They feel judged because they're not as thin as other people think they should be. For me, I feel like I should decide what makes me happy and proud of myself. My body's shape shouldn't be dependent on the expectations of others, whether Hmong or American. I'm Chani Vang, I'm Hmong, and the way I look satisfies me.
That commentary comes to us from the local organization, the No Youth Media. You can see some of the students' visual work on our website, kvpr.org. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. You can also email us, talk@kvpr, or follow us on Twitter at KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Rebecca Plevin, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. Thanks for joining us this week. We hope you'll join us again next time for another Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.